Ecclesiastes, like Job, is not for the faint of heart. It takes us on a world tour of wisdom and folly and vanity, and it's pretty intense. The slide presentation will be very short today because in keeping with, you know, things being vain and not going like we planned, we're not outside, and so I had no plan on having a slide presentation, but I don't remember how, but the Lord brought this picture to mind, and I think it's an apt picture for the vanity that this author speaks of in this very challenging book. And it is challenging. Probably for almost every Christian, the first time they read Ecclesiastes, it is more depressing than encouraging. I would guess that. Much like Job. And it feels like much more questions surface than answers are given. And we don't like that, because we like a faith that is, and a message that is preached and affirmative and clear and concrete, and you can grasp it and you can hold it and you can take it to the bank. And then Ecclesiastes comes along and Job comes along, and they say, whoa, 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 whoa. You really think you have your arms around this? Around this God? Around this life? Can you even explain just last year? Just yesterday? And the things that didn't go your way? And so we need Ecclesiastes, even if we don't want Ecclesiastes. And so it leads me to my first, it's a minor point, and it's a debatable point, a minor point, but it's about authorship and who wrote this word. Traditionally, Solomon has been recognized as the author of this work. And if that holds true, then what the early church fathers said about his three presumed writings are an interesting and helpful bit. And the idea is this. He's got Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. And Proverbs is for really beginners and wisdom. And it gives you a lot of concrete things you feel like you can grab hold of, and that makes sense. Someone does right and they're lifted up. Someone does wrong and they're taken down. This is a good system. And it's all through Proverbs. And you have Song of Solomon, which initiates us, at least in the early church fathers, this was their idea of it. It initiates us into the picture of God's great love for his people. And whether or not you want to say that's the best interpretation of the book, or if it's really emphasizing the beauty of romantic love, I won't get into it. But so you have the picture of being initiated into God's love, the wisdom that helps you as a beginner, and then you have Ecclesiastes, which is a much more mature understanding of the world and of faith, and very challenging. And it's, as I've read it over and over the past week, I recognize that Ecclesiastes is much and maybe more a challenge because of what it doesn't say than what it does. You know, even when Karen was finishing that reading there and I was behind the door, I was thinking, man, that's a steep cliff. And like, where is the netting that's going to catch us? Where is just that sweet resolution? And we can read Ecclesiastes in a way to try to make it do that. Oh, it's got netting somewhere. Don't worry, it's still safe. This book is still safe for the Christian. It still fits nicely in my theology. Everything works out in the end. So there's netting there, and we can search for that netting. And there are those elements of hope given in the book and references to God's judgment despite the fact of death coming for all. But they're pretty scant. They're pretty slim. The bulk of the book is pretty clear from the outset to the close. And if I would sum it up, in Life Under the Sun, the author tells us, and we're challenged to present a different story, tells us life is vain. Life is vain. And that's a short message, but it's a heavy one, and it's a lot to take in. And there are numerous ways where we can skirt out from under it, none of them productive. Back to the writer. So if this is written by Solomon, remember that this is written potentially at the... Well, Solomon was recognized as the height of Israel's kingdom. Maybe not spiritually, but physically, materially, the height of Israel's kingdom. And so if he's the writer, he really does have access to everything under the sun. And that's still the most likely option. The author is only presented as the king of Israel, the son of David. So that still leaves it open which king it could be. When I've thought about it, and it's probably more affected by the fact that I preached about this weeks back in Chronicles than anything else, but when I preached the sermon on fighting futility, we're taking a deep look at Josiah's life as king, because he was the great reformer. It's hard to find a better figure in restoring and building and bringing things back. I don't think I ever got to this picture last time. It doesn't really show you much, but it does show you at least Bethel and gives reference to other part of Samaria where Josiah was the first one, well, the only one, the last, first and last, to take down the high places, the false places of worship, the only one to do it. But he did that right before the kingdom entirely crumbled. And so we wrestled through, what does that mean? And were all his efforts vain? And so when I think about authorship, I've not heard anyone else suggest that Josiah might be it, but I like to picture his life as king and knowing what's coming and still his wrestling through futility and the prophecy that was coming down on the kingdom and doing his level best. But that's just a fun idea. It probably wasn't him. One last thing I'll say about the teacher here, or preacher, the word, and if anyone's studied Ecclesiastes, you've heard by now, Koheleth, that's the word that underlies preacher here. It's not that clear. It's something like an assembler, compiler, someone who might bring people together and also bring wisdom literature together. And so in that way, you might be bringing people together like we have this Sunday to preach at them. But he's not really what most of us would be comfortable calling a preacher. He's a sage, wise teacher, yogi type. You know, he's not just giving us clear dictates of theology, clear dictates of scripture. He is wrestling and dialoguing. And he is much more like a teacher and a sage in that respect. And so I think even preacher might be too much to say about this man. And the last thing I can say about the presenter of Ecclesiastes is that we do have two voices. So there's a flip in the pronouns very early on from third person, someone speaking about the preacher at distance, and then the preacher the whole time is speaking from a first person pronoun, I. This is all his search. I. I sought out. I did wisdom. I sought pleasure. I worked on stuff. I built. I. And then at the end of the book, there's a clear bookend. You leave that pronoun and you return to the third person pronoun. You get it in chapter 12, beginning verse 9, and it's the summary of the book. And it seems likely that it's someone who is not the preacher himself, but someone who is looking at the bulk of Koheleth's teaching, affirming it, which is very important for us, affirming it, not saying this guy was a bozo, this guy went too far, this guy was, you know, throwing weird theories out there, but he says he spoke words of wisdom and of truth. And then he adds a little flavor. And that close is often kind of where we want to run to in Ecclesiastes and skip the middle, because at least there's some resolution here. So let me read that end, even though I'm not urging us to rush through Ecclesiastes. But we have one Sunday to do it, so what can we do? So chapter 12, verse 9 on. Besides being wise, the preacher, okay, so now speaking at distance from third person, Koheleth also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. This is not someone who's, just some hack teacher, just throwing theories around. Someone who has put the message together with great care. Koheleth sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. So that means all that we find in Ecclesiastes, we have to, if we take this as divine word and not just some guy wrestling in himself, divine word, then we have to find ways to affirm the difficult truths that are present through it. The words of the wise are like goads, which are not things you want to bump into, and like nails, also things you don't want to bump into. But the words of the wise are like goads and nails. Firmly fixed are the collected sayings, and they do poke us and prod us. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Now, right away when we read that, we find our resolution in our Christian theology. There's an end, there's a judgment coming, and therefore there must be great reward coming. But when you just look at Koheleth's teaching, we can't really venture what he actually believes about what happens post-death, because he never tells us. And when he does, he suggests a very bleak picture. In terms of our dying and what's next, he compares us to animals. He says, in final regards, as regards death, we're just like animals. They die, we die, and it's over. And he says things like, after you're dead, you don't know things, and you don't praise. And we've seen some of that in the Psalms. You know, the dust will not praise you. So it's a very bleak picture. So we might want to jump to that resolution of this other voice and then cram all of our Christian theology into it and rush over all of the confusion and heartache and sense of vanity that's in the middle. But we do so at a loss to ourselves, because there are many, many lessons. Obviously, we can't get into barely any of them today. But they're Ecclesiastes is not like reading Proverbs. And it's intended to be that way. The one thing that helps us work through Ecclesiastes, really that we have to wrestle down as much as we can, which is difficult because it's a squishy word, is the word hevel. So anybody who's been in the women's study, and presumably you've been a woman in the women's study, what does the word hevel mean? Anyone want to venture? What you've learned? Vapor, okay. Smoke. Okay, so what are some of the ways it's translated for us? So we go right back to what Karen read. And the word's used a lot. It's a hefty load of hevel. Hevel of hevel, says Koheleth. Hevel of hevel, all is hevel. And so we get that as vanity. I think the NIV and a few others will take it as meaningless. But, man, meaningless, that's I think, heavier than is intended. But, yeah, I think this is a good picture, what you first said. Because literally, there's hevel. There's hevel again. More hevel. Now, that's something there. It's not meaningless. Something is happening over and over. Someone might be getting slightly wet even. There's an effect of this hevel, but it's hevel. And no matter how many times I spray, it just keeps on, it's gone. It's there and it's gone. It's there and it's gone. And this is what Koheleth wrestles with all through. And he's trying to find another answer. He's trying to find something that he can grasp and hold on to. And some have articulated this, and even the study book that the women are using now, I think, slightly misses it. The author says this book is really about the question, is life worth living? And I get what he's getting at there, because all through the book, we are wrestling with the meaning of life and the value of life and kind of where we're going. But he never asks the question, is life worth living? And he never presumes that it's not. He never suggests that, therefore, we have an excuse to take a life or take our own. He never gives us that option. He never opens that door. The question that he wrestles with, and I think this helps you a bit as you go through Ecclesiastes, question is, he wrestles with, he assumes that you have to live life. Life is given to you to live. You're already here. It's not a question of if you'll live and if it's worth it. You're here. The question is, where do you go from here? And what can you get out of it? And so I think a better articulation of the question the book is dealing with is, what can I get out of life? What can I gain is literally the question that's asked over and over. And it's in verse 3. This is the question at the heart of the book. And it's not, therefore, an easier question, but I think it's important that we pull back away from the question that maybe we want to ask, is life worth living? And see his question as he phrases it. What does man gain? That's a word of profit. It's a word of surplus, of advantage. It's something over and above. And that gain that he's aiming at, that he's trying to get, that he's trying to grasp, he's looking at it through the word of toil and work. It's a word of productivity, of doing things. It's not just merely living or sitting. It's active. But for all that activity, for all that working hard, for all that toiling, for all that striving, for all the fight we put up to get the things we want or to do the things we find are important, what does man gain? So what's the advantage? What can you really get out of life? And then he makes a very important limiting factor here. So he's already limited to gain through work. And now it's under a very specific constraint, under the sun. So his main challenge is not for what people do in heaven or what they will do in heaven. His main challenge is, what do you do here, and what does it profit you? And then with regard to outcomes, which seems to be what he's driven by, with regard to outcomes, he makes the conclusion over and over, And it's a conclusion we don't want to hear a preacher tell us. Yeah, maybe some wise yogi guy would say something like this. But we don't want to hear a preacher say, life is vain. Death is coming. Taxes are due. End of story. But he says it quite a bit. I'll just give you a dabble of his expression of this hevel, this vanity. And the graph here, which I haven't talked about, it's just to show, you know, some of the things I've shown here of words of importance or phrases of importance. Anyone who reads Ecclesiastes, you can't miss hevel. You can't miss vanity. Or if you want to take the most negative aspect of it, meaninglessness, which I don't think is appropriate, at least not in every setting. But clearly, this book is about this author trying to get away from this conclusion, finding some way to get gain, but he keeps on coming back to vain. It's like he's putting different inputs into an algorithm to see what he'll get out. And he keeps on putting, okay, I'm going to put in pleasure, death. I'm going to put in work, death. Okay, I'll put in folly, madness, death. And it keeps putting out the same computation. Here's a smattering of, just from the first couple chapters, because it is overwhelming, of his expressions about this vanity, starting with the one that was already read today. Chapter 1, verse 2. Don't feel the need to follow me. I'll spend some time in one spot and help you there. Vanity of vanities, says Koheleth. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Verse 12 to 17. I, Koheleth, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out wisdom by all that is done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And of course he hasn't, but he's seen as much as anyone has. I've seen everything that's done under the sun. So it's limited to that. He's not seeing the heavenlies. He's not seeing hell. And behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. That vapor, that mist, and it's gone. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity, hevel. An important thing I'll insert right here is, and there's a lot of side notes. I'll try not to get into all of them. But this one's important. When we read this book, I think it's easy for us to presume that when he says he searches out all this paths to see what we can gain, well, what he could gain to get ahead, it doesn't mean he did everything. We don't see anything approaching a description of him trying out women's clothes, which is a vain thing that people are trying today, and probably some were trying in his day. But we don't see him doing that. We see descriptions of him saying he ate and drank and had pleasure. And so we might just twist that with our, you know, movie-filled brains and go, yeah, this was just a weeks-long or years-long sorority party, and that's not the picture. And we know that because he says at different points, I pursued these things by wisdom, not by utter folly. I didn't seek out to do evil. You know, I tested folly, but not evil. And in chapter 2, verse 3, this is where I get this qualifier. He says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine and inserts for us who assume he just became an alcoholic right away, "My heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life." So he is testing things out, but he's not the prodigal son. And so when we read this as this crazy teacher who is just trying everything on, it's not true. And he does everything with respect in some way to God. Which is why the command that he gives all throughout his teaching is the one I gave last week. Fear God. Fear God. And so he doesn't test absolutely everything. So we need to understand that. I think that's helpful as we read. He did not give himself license to do anything, though I wouldn't argue that he did nothing dumb in the process. In another exhibition of life being vain, chapter 2, verse 9 through 11, he says, "So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, looking at all this great work." This isn't a bunch of disgusting stuff he's done. He's built things. He's made vineyards. He's been productive. "I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun." It's like he keeps on saying, when I get to the end, no matter how much I have in my savings account, it's at zero at the end. No matter how much I save, no matter how much I put at the bank, it's back to zero. And I die. I realize this is very encouraging, so let's keep the encouragement. Probably the most encouraging verse, if I can continue being sarcastic with your blessing, is verse 17 from chapter 2. This is probably the darkest, if not one of the most dark places. Here, it's clear that he's not just saying, things are hard to grasp, I can't hold them, but I'll keep going. Here, you really sense that he is wrestling with the sense of meaninglessness and vanity in the darkest sense. When he uses the word hatred, as much as I want to keep things to be light and breathy and back to the vapor, it's intense. After reflecting on his work especially, "I hated my life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind." It's like after all that work, the computation comes out the same. And so what do you do with that? Well, one thing that people do in our world, and maybe sometimes we do, when we face things that we cannot understand, when the computer is not spitting out the answer we want, when God is not acting like the Proverbs computer, sometimes we turn to despair. Maybe even as a comforter, we turn to despair. So verse 20, "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun." Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. Also, that person might spend it in a rotten way, which he says in another place. So he says, "This also is vanity and a great evil." And he asks that question again, seemingly about gain. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. It's like he's saying, even when I try to despair, the despair doesn't work. Even when I try to give up, the giving up doesn't help. And here, I think it's useful. I won't go through all the references. There are plenty. Koheleth takes this long, long journey to kind of come back to where he started. G.K. Chesterton, he wasn't referencing this, but he says at the beginning of his book, Everlasting Man, there are two ways of getting home, and one of them is to stay there. The other is to walk around the whole world till we come back to the same place. And that seems to be what happens with the writer of Ecclesiastes. But when he comes back, I want to be clear about this. When he comes back, because sometimes when we read Ecclesiastes, we just get sad. When we come back, when he comes back, he does not conclude with despair and sadness, even though he concludes that life is vain. See, this is a real... this is a book of wrestling. It's a dialogue of wrestling. Wrestling within himself, wrestling with God, wrestling with the world. But he doesn't conclude that because life is vain, do evil. Because life is vain, do whatever you want. Because life is vain, get wasted. Because life is vain, cheat on your wife. Because life is vain, give up. Take a life. Take your own. He never gets there. He does say life is vain, though. And sometimes we want to say, well, because he didn't say these outcomes, he must not really be meaning life is vain. But he does. And I'd be dishonest to say anything else. I wanted him to not say that. I read through over and over to say he doesn't really mean that, right? But he begins and ends the book with the same phrases. Vanity of vanity. Vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. We can be pretty certain he's saying what he's saying. But what he's saying does not lead him to. Even though for a time he expresses the hatred of life, it doesn't leave him in a place of permanent hatred and misery. It doesn't bring him there. And it doesn't bring him there to teach others. Remember, he's a teacher. Like, what's he setting up everyone to do? He's setting up everyone to just be crazy. He's setting up a world of chaos. He's setting up homes of dysfunction. No. Because after he says, yeah, life is vain, he still says, so here's the application. Fear God. But life is vain. Shh. I know. I went around the whole world to come back to that point. It's vain. It almost feels like nothing's changing when I look at the world, that chapter one poem. The water's going round and round, keeps on going, keeps on going. When are the rivers going to run out? They don't. They keep on going. When does the wind stop? It doesn't. The wind keeps on going. Uses the word round like five times in that one verse. But he doesn't say, therefore, despair. It might surprise us when we look at his commands, what he's telling the young to do and the old alike. But he, of course, specifically addresses the young. He tells them what? It's very surprising in Ecclesiastes. Life is vain, enjoy. Whoa. Now, I'm reading that as a reader, and my brain is saying, cannot compute. Okay, you just gave me the input of life is vain, so I want to say, let's go crazy. The rest of life is going to be the bachelor party. Forget the wedding and the marriage and all that. Just the crazy bachelor party. But that's not the answer to the math he does. He says, yeah, life is vain. enjoy it. Fear the Lord. Yeah, don't stress yourself out trying to figure everything out. Don't be too wise, he tells us. He's a wisdom teacher. This is what he gets, not what he gets paid to do because he's a king, but it's kind of his whole thing as a wisdom teacher. You'd think to advance that, you have to tell people you also have to pursue wisdom, but the end of his thing is don't be too wise. Yeah, don't be a fool, but don't be too wise. Don't try to figure it all out. Enjoy life, eat and drink, do your work with all your might, he says. Do your work with all your might. Even though Josiah's kingdom is going to fall right after he dies early, he gets killed in battle. And you're going to tell me to sweat and to work and to enjoy that? Yep. And it's not the nice, clean resolution we want. But it's what we find in Ecclesiastes. And it's become clear to me that it is a message that we need, because when we're only ever satisfied in knowing the end, it seems to me that there is a lack of faith that can carry us there. I'll only follow God if I know it'll work out nicely. I'll only follow God if my children will follow in his ways and never depart. I'll only follow God if I never get fired or never lose a house. I'll only follow God. And that's not how life works. It's not how Ecclesiastes works. It says, you will experience vanity in this life and you will die. P.S. There's no better thing for you to do than enjoy your life and to fear God. And it's not the resolution we want. But that's kind of as good as we get in Ecclesiastes if we're honest about it. And again, we can rush to bring our Christian heritage and our Christian where things are going and just logjam it in there. It also means we won't learn the lessons of Ecclesiastes for today. I'm going to talk about Jesus Christ. I'm going to talk about why that changes the math, why he changes the math. I'm going to talk about why Jesus and his revelation and his work was really a new thing on the earth. A brand new and beautiful thing. But this book is still for Christians. And it's not for Christians just because it's part of the story that wasn't concluded. It's not just important because it sets us up for Christ and makes us long for something else, which it does. One commentator actually said about it that Ecclesiastes is the absolute strongest messianic prophecy in the whole of the Old Testament. We're thinking, what? Because it is a march to death and it leaves us begging and pleading for hope, which only a Messiah can bring. But it also has the message of vanity. And so it tells us true and hard things. The people in this bench are going to die. The people in this bench are going to suffer and die. The people right here are going to suffer and are going to die. The people right here will suffer and will die. These people here cannot avoid suffering and death. Suffering and death will come to you guys. And to you guys, I'm going to do more funerals of people in this room. Death is coming to you. I don't know when. And to you. Sorry, ladies. I'm so glad to see you today. But death is coming to you. And to you. And to you. And to you. And to you, Pat. I'm sorry. Heh. No, you're not. Good. I'm going to skip this row. We're just in case there is a rapture like that, skip this row. No, you guys are dying. And that's heavy. And that's real. And sometimes our Christianity can scapegoat the real under the cross of Christ. It's, trust me, my hope is in Christ, and I'll speak of him as my only hope. But there is a true vanity that we will experience here. Some of your children are experiencing it now and have in the past year. And some of your parents and some of your friends. And all of us will experience that vanity. And if we skip over that understanding, and if we try to make Ecclesiastes say other easier, more comfortable things, when the suffering comes, and especially for our friends and family, when the suffering comes, we will set ourselves up to be Job's comforters. Because we will not understand. We will not wrestle with the fact that life is hard. And under the sun, it is vain. And we really can't get ahead. And we can't hold it, and we can't grasp it. But even Koheleth, who's not preaching resurrection at every turn, even he says, you can still enjoy life. You should still fear God. You should still act in faith. Though life is vain. And in so many ways, he's right to do this. He articulates in many different ways why this is true. Not in every instance, but in the end game of every instance. Why it's true that life is vain. But from the history of humanity, from the moment we decided it was better not to trust God and that we could get more out of life by going against his command, from that moment on, the world and everything in it was subject to futility, was subject to groaning, was subject to pain and to death. And so the very first sun, the very first born sun in humanity becomes a murderer. The first hope. Remember, the promise was given to Adam and Eve that a son shall come from you. A son will come, and he's going to change things. And so the first son is born, and there is a hope expressed. And I see it in Eve's own words from Genesis 4:1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. That may seem like an insignificant phrase, but she has been given the promise that a son will come from you and stomp on Satan, the snake's head. And so there's a hope, I believe, she expresses there. I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord, but that man becomes a murderer. And from the outside of the garden till now, life under the sun has been vain. The computation leading to death. It's interesting. Back to the word hevel. And we will be done in 5 minutes or less. When you look at the word hevel, it also appears in a strange place, which is the beginning. So fourth line there, you'll see Genesis. Shows up 8 times, What's Hevel doing in Genesis? Is that an expression of the vanity and this futility and this groaning? Sort of, but it's expressed in a person because it's actually the brother of Cain. Hevel is his name. We know him as Abel, but Hevel is his name. It's not like a play on the name, it's the name. So when you do the word search, it shows right up. In the Hebrew, not the English, obviously. But the son, whose name means breath, vapor, vanity, was the first one subject to it when he was killed by the first son, Cain. Now we get to the Christian part, because this was not the last time that Hevel gets killed. There would be a final son of man. And stick with me, it sounds weird at first, but like Cain, this final son of man would be a murderer too. His name is Jesus. But his murder was not wrought by violence or vengeance brought upon another son, because he was the only son of his father. He was a perfect one. And the violence and vengeance that Cain expressed, that was allotted to him to bear. And so Jesus experienced a vicious end. And that was his portion. That was his allotment. The cross was his cup. The grave was his garment. Jesus, Son of God, subject to the same vanity, futility of death that you and I will be. But I said that Jesus was a murderer of Hevel. And that's because when he died on the cross and rose again, he didn't kill Abel, he killed vanity. He killed futility. He killed the groaning that every human being has ever experienced. For those who trust in his death and his resurrection, he killed Hevel. And so while we are subject to Hevel in this life, we trust the New Testament word that says that Jesus' blood was not like all the other blood shed in the world. Jesus' blood was not like all of the other innocents who died. There was something different. And Hebrews 12 tells it to us in verses 21 to 24. Indeed, he's comparing, looking at Mount Sinai compared to Mount Zion and this belief in Jesus. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering. This is what you come to in Jesus. And to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new, yes, new, brand new covenant. And to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Hevel. I'm not sure I understand all that that means, but I'm clear after reading Ecclesiastes this time and seeing the connection that I know it better. Jesus' blood sprinkled for us speaks a better word than the blood of Hevel, Abel. And why? Why does Christ's blood speak any different than any other who have died, either dying in guilt or dying in innocence? Because Abel's blood accomplished nothing. Abel's blood was subject to vanity. The ground drank it in. Abel's blood did not and could not work righteousness. Abel's blood did not and could not work resurrection. Abel's blood did not restore Abel. Even though it screamed something appropriate, this isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to be. This isn't how I'm supposed to go. Brothers don't do that. This is evil. His blood was saying things like that. But there were things it couldn't say. And neither could Abel's blood ever say or claim to say that it could save Cain, who killed him. But the blood of Christ, it can and it does reach and restore and heal and resurrect and bring back. And his blood can forgive even Cain, the murderer. Was killed. He died killing Hevel. And life is not vain for the Christian, though we experience vanity, and though we will die, and though we will have toil, and though we will scratch our heads, and though we will pray for rain, pray for sun and get rain, we will experience Hevel. We shouldn't run through Ecclesiastes. But praise God for Jesus' blood that speaks a better word than Hevel. I can't not give you the New Testament today. You stuck with me through all the pain and all the Hevel. Where's this book? We've been in the Old Testament so long, I don't even know where things are in the New Testament. Paul picked up on the vanity that we wrestle with when we wonder in our time, not just in the Old Testament, we wonder in our time, is all the work that we do as individuals and as this church body, is it just Hevel? First Corinthians 15, verse 32, the question is posed. Rhetorically, what do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with the beasts at Ephesus if the dead are not raised? Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Hevel. If the dead are not raised, continuing from verse 45, because the dead are raised. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, he's speaking of Christ, became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. I tell you this, brothers, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. This is new. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable, and this mortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on the immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brothers and sisters, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, not under the sun, but in the sun, that brings you to a new place. That changes the math. You are not just under the sun, though you suffer under it. You are in the sun, and you have victory in him. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Hallelujah.